Hey everybody, this is Wade, and before I start the show, I want to tell you quickly about a great new app for finding and following podcasts. It's called Radio Public, and it helps you put together a kind of personalized radio station based on the shows you like. It's also got playlists curated by people with good taste in audio. And the big news is that this week, Radio Public is featuring my own playlist of podcasts that relate to the future in various ways. You'll find episodes from 99% Invisible, Flash Forward, Imaginary Worlds, and a bunch of other great shows. So download Radio Public now to your iOS or Android device, click on the binoculars button, and look for the playlist called News from the Future. I think you'll enjoy it. And now on with the show. Actually, before we start, I just got some sad news that I need to share with all of you. This episode's all about monorails, and one of the main voices you'll hear is that of Kim Peterson, who was the founder and president of a group called the Monorail Society. I met Kim at his home in Fremont, California last October, and I knew he'd been struggling with cancer, but he seemed to be doing pretty well. Just hours after I published this episode this morning, I got the news that Kim had passed away. Kim was certainly one of the world's most knowledgeable and enthusiastic people on the subject of monorails, but he was also a super friendly and helpful person, and I was really grateful to get to know him. I know there are a lot of people in the monorail community who are already missing him dearly. I'm not going to change anything about this episode, but I do want to take this chance to dedicate the show to Kim's memory. Okay, here we go for real. I'm Wade Rausch, and this is Soonish. It's a show about the future, how we think about it, what we can do to shape it, and why our best forecasts and our worst fears are usually wrong. I want to start today's episode by taking you on a trip to the future. Not our future exactly, but the future the way it looked to AT&T back in 1962 in a promotional film called Century 21 Calling. During the movie's opening credits, the camera is zooming along on top of a concrete beam 30 feet above the streets of some bustling city. You're rushing past the buses and the traffic below, and then the camera pans up and you see the towering Space Needle. And you realize you're inside a monorail car and you're on your way to the Seattle World's Fair. A moment later, you pass another monorail car going impossibly fast in the opposite direction. You round a curve and enter the station, and you step off the monorail into a fairgrounds that looks just like a scene from a Jetsons cartoon.
All passengers must leave the train at this terminal. Round-trip passengers, turn to your left as you leave the train. Exit to your right.
The rest of the film is about the Bell Systems Pavilion at the fair, and it's funny to watch actors showing off technologies that must have seemed miraculous at the time, like conference calling and pagers and call waiting. But I think the opening is the best part of the AT&T film, because it lets the viewer arrive at the fair exactly the same way millions of actual fairgoers did, on the monorail. These futuristic trains serve as a grand entrance to a whole future world, where you can learn about computers and jet planes and space travel and have lunch inside a flying saucer 500 feet above the ground. Maybe the reason I like the film so much is that it reminds me of my own first experience riding a monorail at Walt Disney World in Florida when I was just 10 years old. I remember boarding at the crowded parking lot, passing right through the lobby of the Contemporary Hotel, arriving at the Magic Kingdom, and going straight to my favorite part of the park, which, of course, was Tomorrowland. The sleek, streamlined monorail seemed like the perfect way to travel from the present into the future. And monorails have held on to that image as the trains of the future, partly because they just look cool, and partly because they have some real advantages. For one thing, they're safer and cheaper to operate than other forms of mass transit, which led to predictions in the 1960s and 70s that monorails would pop up in dozens of American cities. But the truth is that in the US, there still aren't many monorail systems outside of theme parks. And they obviously haven't displaced older technologies like buses, subways, and light rail. So it's fair to ask, if monorails are so cool, why don't we have more of them? For this week's show, I went looking for people who could help me answer that question.
It's sad, you know, you'd think that you'd want to go for the most efficient system, but the industry sometimes leans towards the one that makes the most money.
Runs on electricity.
So even if it's, you know, a bad day at work, it's always a good day on the train.
We carry 2 million passengers a year.
Voters wanted monorail.
Each train has gone over 1 million miles.
And they voted for it 4 times in Seattle.
We worked and barely had tested the train 3 days before opening of the World's Fair.
So sadly, Seattle did not get the monorail. Houston almost got a monorail, and the same thing happened there. Politics got involved.
Back in Seattle, you can still ride to the Space Needle on the monorail. So that's where I went first, to try to figure out whether monorails are a thing of the past, or whether they still have a future. And how many times do you go back and forth in 8 hours?
Usually if you're making, you make about 6 trips an hour, ideally, but so usually between 36 to 40 something.
Kylan Sandstrom is a full-time monorail conductor in Seattle and a part-time college student studying anthropology. She says she likes working on the monorail because it gives her a chance to talk with all sorts of people, especially kids. But she says she's also sort of fallen in love with the trains themselves.
Like, I love these trains a lot. I have nicknames for them and everything. And yeah, so even if it's, you know, a bad day at work, it's always a good day on the train.
What's your nickname for this train?
This is Bluebell, and the other one is Scarlet Reddington, because Blue Train and Red Train.
Are these just your personal names? Or?
Yeah, they haven't really caught on yet, but I'm working on it. I'm working on it.
Okay. Now, to me, being a monorail conductor seems like a pretty great job. But the truth is, you'd have an easier time getting hired as an anthropologist or a pastry chef. That's because all the action in monorails these days is in countries like China, Brazil, and South Korea. Here in the U.S., there are only 9 operating monorail systems. Seattle came close to building a new monorail system, but that project died in 2005. And instead, the city built a costly and honestly kind of pokey light rail system. There's an argument that big cities should offer a mix of transportation options, including monorails. But at some point in recent history, the word monorail started to sound like the punchline of a joke. And to see how that happened, we've got to take a detour to Springfield. I mean, the fictional one.
The name's Lanley, Lyle Lanley. I give you the Springfield Monorail. That's right, monorail.
Monorail, monorail, monorail.
I hear those things are awfully loud.
It glides as softly as a cloud.
Is there a chance the track could bend?
Not on your life, my Hindu friend.
Monorail.
What's it called?
Monorail.
Once again.
Monorail.
The infamous Simpsons episode.
Kim Peterson is the founder and president of the Monorail Society. The group includes both monorail fans and professional monorail engineers, and it has 7,000 members around the world. How did you feel when you saw that episode, or when you...
Well, I laughed, for one thing. It's a hilarious episode. And then as time went on and people kept mentioning that episode, that's being the first thing that comes to their mind when you say monorail. And it's just one more typecasting I have to deal with.
Peterson helped in the early planning of the project to expand the Seattle monorail. And he's been working to undo the damage from that satirical Simpsons episode ever since it first aired more than 20 years ago.
Monorail has been typecast over the years, and especially in our country, the United States. It's seen as a fun park ride or a theme park ride. And monorails are serving very well as transit systems, and we want to get the word out that they are available as an option for transit.
Recently, Peterson published a big illustrated book called Monorails, Trains of the Future, Now Arriving. So I thought I'd ask him to help me understand where monorails came from and where they're going.
Monorail has had a sad history of could have, should have. In fact, there is a chapter called Could Have, Should Have. There was great promise for monorails being built everywhere, but they, for various reasons, they didn't take off in the United States particularly. Or Europe, for that matter. But the Japanese took hold to them, and right now The title Now Arriving is more appropriate because we're having a monorail explosion around the world.
Are we really?
Absolutely. What's going on in China is insane right now. They started from zero with high-speed rail just a few years ago, and now they have the most massive system on the planet. It's going to be the same thing within the next 10 to 15 years with monorails.
Peterson says the city of Chongqing in southwest China has built 35 miles of monorail tracks, which makes their system the world's largest. He thinks China could turn into a monorail superpower. That would be quite a reversal, considering that the first really famous monorail was built here in the U.S., at Disneyland in California.
Present Walt Disney's Disneyland.
The Disneyland system opened in 1959, and it was the creation of a company called Alweg.
It's kind of a long story tracing back. The Alweg company originally was financed and developed by Axel Leonard Werner Green.
A-L-W-E-G.
That's right, yeah.
Einar Svensson is a structural engineer from Norway. And he was hired by Alweg in 1962 after the company offered to build the monorail at the Seattle World's Fair. Thanks to that project, along with the monorails at Disneyland and Disney World, the Alweg model became the one everyone thinks of when they hear the word monorail. I met Svensson at his home on Vashon Island, outside Seattle. It's easy to find his house because there's a working scale model of a monorail in the yard. I asked him to tell me more about the Alweg design.
Mono means one. And rail means rail. And that concludes our intensive 3-week course.
Actually, that's The Simpsons again. Real monorail engineers, like Svensson, call the rail the beamway.
It's a large beamway. It's close to 90 centimeters, 1 meter wide, and 1.5 meter deep. And we train kind of envelope around it.
Basically, an Alweg train is like a bus with wheels that curl around the beamway. And just like a bus, an Alweg monorail runs on rubber tires. That's important because it makes the ride smooth and it gives the trains lots of traction for accelerating and braking. When you can brake quickly, you don't need to keep so much distance between the trains, the way you do with steel-wheeled rail cars. And that means you can put more trains on the track and carry more people per hour than a typical light rail system. Svensson didn't know any of this when Alweg first hired him, but he had to become an instant expert in order to help them finish the monorail in time for the World's Fair.
But essentially, we worked all the way up and barely had tested the train 3 days before opening of the World's Fair. It was that close.
3 days?
Yeah. We lifting the car by crane and set it so it fit right on top or around that big beam. It had not been done before, so everything was done on paper prior to. So this was a very concern, and that turned out to fit just perfect.
The Alweg monorail worked so perfectly that 8 million people rode it to the World's Fair. After the fair, the city kept the monorail going. And today, the trains are operated by a private company called Seattle Monorail Services. The general manager at the company is a man named Tom Diddy, and he gave me a backstage tour at the company's maintenance facility.
If you stand there, you can see the guide tires, and they're in a triangular form on either side, and that's what guides the train.
So they're hugging the train to the guide, to the rail on both sides.
Yep.
And then there's another set of tires that the weight of the train is resting on, is that right?
And those are the load tires, and there are 16 of them, 8 sets yoked together in pairs of two that bring the 42 tons of train up and down from here to downtown Seattle.
Right. And then, so what we're standing next to right now is sort of, I guess you might call it the skirt. This metal outer part is kind of covering up the guide tires.
Yeah.
And it's also a little bit decorative on the front.
Yeah, it's very 1962 George Jetson probably proposed to his wife on it, something like that.
Meet George Jetson!
The Jetsons reference is appropriate, given that the animated show was on the air in 1962. At the same time, Seattle was hosting the World's Fair. In the show, George and Judy Jetson and their kids lived in an apartment building in the sky that looked just like the Space Needle. And George went to work in a flying car. And in a way, riding the monorail also feels like flying. When you're zooming over the traffic on Seattle's Fifth Avenue, you can imagine the drivers stuck down there in their cars, looking up and wishing they were on the monorail.
I've done that on my commute home, sitting underneath watching my own train go by above me. Hey, stop!
Let me get on.
Yeah. But it's very efficient in crowded areas. One advantage that it has over regular light rail is if there's a traffic jam on the street, the light rail is still part of that traffic jam. And so monorail, I think, in heavily congested areas works very well. It's not unlike the subway, just 30 feet in the air instead of 30 feet below ground.
I spent a lot of time talking with the people who built the Seattle monorail and the people who run it today. And the longer I stayed, the more I could see why the people of Seattle fell in love with Bluebell and Scarlett Reddington. I could also understand why thousands of people in Seattle got behind a proposal in the late 1990s to build a new monorail system. But that project fell apart in 2005. And while I was in town, I wanted to find out what that story says about the politics of urban transportation and the uphill climb that monorails face in the U.S. That meant I had to seek out one more person.
My name is Dick Falconberry. I'm a semi-retired tour operator in Seattle, Washington. I'm 6'2" and 247 pounds, down from 270. I'm so proud.
Dick Falconberry is famous in Seattle for his encyclopedic knowledge of the city's neighborhoods, which he was happy to share with me during a long drive around town. But he's also known for dreaming up the ballot initiative that turned monorails into a grassroots movement in Seattle. This was 1995 or so, and because he'd been a cab driver, Falconberry was sick and tired of Seattle's traffic. He knew there was a plan to build a light rail system, but he didn't think it would help people get around faster, since light rail trains often travel at street level, where they have to compete with cars and bicycles.
In order to get through traffic, you have to be separated. And separating on the surface simply never works. It just doesn't work.
So in 1997, Falconberry and his friends got enough signatures to put a monorail proposal on the Seattle ballot. Under their plan, the city would have been crisscrossed with 54 miles of new Alweg-style beamways, carrying fast elevated trains. The initiative passed, and so did three more monorail measures between 2000 and 2004. In those early years, things were looking so good for the monorail that Falconberry, speaking to a TV reporter, made a bold promise.
They asked me, they go, is it really going to be built? I said, I'll make you a pinky bet. And the guy was a really funny reporter. He goes, what's a pinky bet? I go, I'll cut off my little finger if it isn't built. And when he came back to the anchor, she went, you!
I'm looking at your hands, Dick, and it looks like you've got all your fingers still.
Yeah, I sometimes bluff a little bit. I'm known to bluff.
It's a good thing it was a bluff, because City Hall in Seattle had already put its support behind the light rail project. Falconberry says this political opposition started to bring the whole project down. On top of that, he says the monorail authority made some bad design choices that inflated the project's overall cost.
They were convinced that the only way to build up enough political power at the voting box was this notion that you had to build up a big contracts and then big employees.
In 2005, the Monorail Authority revealed that interest payments could add $9 billion to the project's cost. That led to a fifth referendum that finally shut down the project.
Voters wanted monorail. They liked monorail. They really were passionate about it, and they voted for it four times in Seattle.
That's Kim Peterson again.
But the people that were in charge of putting this system together kind of padded the costs to where it was became prohibitive in expense. And the mayor was no fan of monorail to begin with. His baby was the light rail system they had already started. So he used that as an excuse to help kill it. So sadly, Seattle did not get the monorail. Houston almost got a monorail, and the same thing happened there. Politics got involved.
Now, it shouldn't be a big surprise when infrastructure proposals come up against local politics. In the U.S., the federal government has been putting less and less money into transportation projects. So it's natural to see more wrangling over spending priorities. There is one form of mass transit that's gotten more local investment lately, and that's light rail, with projects popping up everywhere from Phoenix to Minneapolis. But monorails can carry more people per hour than light rail, and they never get into collisions with cars and bicycles and pedestrians. So why don't cities build monorails instead? I ran into two main explanations. One is that monorails are too expensive. The other is that they aren't expensive enough. Explanation one comes from Tom Diddy.
I think it's the initial cost that is the big deterrent. You can put in a mile of light rail much cheaper than you can put in a mile of monorail track. And the trains themselves are going to cost about the same. So I'm going to stick with, if I have to give one simple answer, it'll be money.
The upfront capital costs.
Yep. Mm-hmm.
But Kim Peterson says light rail is more expensive than people think, especially after you account for maintenance costs.
Something I've heard from industry folks, see, kind of quietly on the side, is that there's no money in monorails. You can make a lot more money digging up a city street, having to re-engineer an entire street to put track in it, and also the system itself requires a lot more money just to maintain it. It's sad, you know, you'd think that you'd want to go for the most efficient system, but the industry sometimes leans towards the one that makes the most money.
So that's explanation two. Dick Falconberry could still be right that the Seattle monorail died partly due to overpadded expenses and financing issues. But maybe the answer would have been to jack up the price even more, to compete with Seattle's $5.2 billion light rail system. Einar Svensson thinks that someday monorails could catch on again in the U.S. But before that can happen, he thinks we need new technology and better education.
I eventually came up with an entirely new technology where there is no beamway, but a small guide rail instead of. And that's where the design and development of the Urbanaut started.
The Urbanaut is Svensson's concept for a new kind of monorail with a thinner beamway that he says is cheaper to build than the old Alwick tracks. When visitors come, Svensson shows them the scale model Urbanaut he built in his backyard. In Incheon, South Korea, transportation authorities built the world's first full-scale Urbanaut monorail in 2009, but then mothballed it due to alleged construction flaws. Svensson says one key to getting more Urbanaut systems built would be to teach monorail technology to engineering students, not to mention politicians.
I have a little story. During the World's Fair, there comes a British delegation, and the head of the delegation is Prince Philip. I took him up in front, you know, of a train and put him between the driver and myself. And he's sitting there looking down and he says, "You're the engineer." "Yes," I said. "What prevent this big train from falling up at small beamway?" So I took him over to the maintenance facility. And he said he wanted to see how it functioned. I took him down there, and he got really interested in it. And he said, "Einar, I fully understand how it now works." Now, he's really the only person who asked that question and wanted to learn about it. It's kind of interesting to show that if there were more individuals like him, we might have had some more knowledge of Urbanaut or Alwick.
If only somebody had put Prince Philip in charge of rebuilding the technology infrastructure.
Yeah, you're not kidding.
So in the end, here's what I think you can say about monorail technology. It's faster than street traffic because it gets riders above the fray. It's generally safer and cheaper to operate than light rail, but it has a big image problem. And it's one that probably goes all the way back to Disneyland.
You know, Walt Disney was trying to demonstrate to the world what a great idea the monorail was, and exact opposite happened. It became typecast as a theme park ride.
That's a really good word, typecasting. I hadn't thought of it that way before, but you're absolutely right. Once people start thinking of a monorail as something that you got to see one at the theme park, then when somebody proposes building one in their town, they might kind of like tilt their head and like say, what?
Yeah. Well, in fact, every time I've seen over the last 30 years of watching this, many times the detractors will bring up, well, we don't need Mickey Mouse Transit. You know, they'll degrade the idea right from the start because that's something for Disney.
But clearly, monorails aren't just for Disney. If the technology is good enough for Sao Paulo and Panama City and Shanghai and Riyadh and Kuala Lumpur, then it ought to be good enough for Boston and San Francisco. But upgrading our infrastructure takes boldness, ambition, and tax dollars. And in a lot of U.S. cities, it seems like all three of those are in short supply. Back in Seattle, Tom Diddy says hundreds of people still ride the monorail to work every day. And Seattle's vintage Alweg trains have a special place in the city's heart.
I believe it's got a very iconic role in the look of Seattle. The people of Seattle like it. You know, if Aunt Marge comes in from Dubuque, Iowa, you're going to take her to the Space Needle, you're going to take her to Pike Place Market, and you're going to get from each of them by monorail.
The system is 54 years old.
Yep.
If you add another 54 years to that, it gets us to the year 2070. Mm-hmm. Do you think the monorail will still be running then?
Absolutely. We'll continue to modify as we need to, as technology changes. I know the motors and the electrical system that brings the power into the train is getting pretty antiquated. Probably leave direct current and go to alternating current. So there are changes that we're going to have to do, but I promise you that if we're given the support from the city that we've gotten up to this point, and it's been very good, that those trains will be running 50 years from now.
What's the most fun thing about your job?
I think if I had to pick my favorite thing to do, it's when I get a group of third graders coming through in awe, and I take them down below to show them the same tires that you saw, and those tires, you know, come up to their chin, and you tell them that it runs on electricity, and that we carry 2 million passengers a year, and that each train has gone over 1 million miles, and just to see those kids go, I like that. That's neat. That's exciting. And so they get a little history, they get a little science, and maybe 10 years from then, they'll come and apply for a job here, and I'll teach them how to drive it.
Soonish is written and produced by me, Wade Rausch. The show's theme is by Graham Gordon Ramsey. Additional music this week by Blue Dot Sessions and Grant Fikes. I got valuable production advice on this episode from Mitch Hanley and John Barth. If you like the show, there are three small things you can do that will help to brighten our future. The first is to subscribe to the show on iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play Music, TuneIn, or wherever you get your podcasts. The second is to rate and review the show on iTunes, which really helps other people find us. And third and equally important, please help to spread the news about the show via Facebook or Twitter or old-fashioned word of mouth. You can follow the show on Twitter at Soonish Podcast, and I love to get your email comments at info@soonishpodcast.org. Thanks this week to my guests Tom Diddy, Dick Falconberry, Kim Peterson, Kylan Sandstrom, and Einar Svensson. Thanks also to my friends Luke Timmerman and Tracy Kutchlow for hosting me in Seattle, and to Dick Falconberry for giving me an amazing tour of the city. You can go to Amazon to find Dick's book, Rise Above It All, and also Kim Peterson's book, Monorails, Trains of the Future, Now Arriving. For more information about all of the people and ideas in this episode, you can go to the show's website at soonishpodcast.org, where this week I've also posted the film Century 21 Calling and my full interviews with Kim Peterson and Tom Diddy. Thanks for listening, and we'll be back with a new episode soonish.
We monorail conductors are a crazy breed, half in love with death, gobbling up danger like ordinary men eat peanuts.